The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Michael Tracy is a freelance journalist who has written for publications including Vice, The Daily Beast, The American Conservative, and The Guardian. He is also a former reporter for TYT. Tracy is a member of a small set of leftish Russia collusion skeptics. He's on the list that includes Glenn Greenwald, Matt Taibbi, Aaron Mate, and a few others. In this podcast, we discuss the Mueller report, the Barr letter, the Russian collusion investigation, and the failure of most journalists to be skeptical and consistent since 2016. It's Thursday, April 11th, 2019, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. Before we start, I want to say that I'm aware that many people feel as though we don't know the truth about Trump's involvement with Russia, and that we won't know until after the Mueller report is released to the public. My feeling is that whatever's in the report, it's clear that the idea that Trump conspired with Russia to fix the election is no longer viable. It's a dead end politically, maybe even a counterproductive idea for people who want to protect democratic institutions and civil liberties. This week's podcast is available in full for our patrons. Our Patreon supporters get access to two podcasts every week, Symptomatic Redness and Zero Squared. But if you're listening on our free feed, you'll always be able to access one or the other podcast each week. At the moment, we have 588 patrons. When we reach 600, we'll introduce a new series of patron-only videos, tentatively entitled Communism 101. The music you're listening to right now is a dubstep remix of the Tetris theme created by Music 8-Bits on YouTube. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Michael Tracy and I discuss the death of the Russia-Trump conspiracy. I expect that you're going to find in the weeks to come that more and more people are going to say that the Mueller report isn't conclusive or that it should be ignored, that certainly the people are already saying that Barr is acting in bad faith, isn't a reputable source for information, that his synopsis should be disregarded. So I expect a good portion of the, let's just call it like the Democratic base, will not be swayed. But, you know, people who are members of religious cults who like have doomsday prophecies, yeah, will frequently become more adamantly committed when the date comes and goes and there's no end of the world or no
plan. Right. It reminds me of the Harold Camping cult. Remember that guy who prophesied that the earth was – that the rapture was going to come in May of 2011? And it came and went. Yeah, yeah. And they had billboards all over the country. Family Radio was the name of this like radio network that he had. And when it didn't come, I think it was May 21st, 2011, if I'm not mistaken. I had this like perverse fascination with it at the time. I should try to like go visit their radio station in New Jersey near me. But when it came and went, it was just like they went radio silent for a couple days. And then Harold kept them, which was like, oh, yeah, it's actually October. And then October came and went, and he was like, okay, I guess I was actually pretty wrong here. I got to go study the Bible more. And it's just like there's a similar stuff. I mean, these people all have their sacred texts, one of which is the sealed dossier.
Let's go back to this question about whether there should be an investigation. Yeah. And I just want to put this into context a little bit. It seems to me that there is ample evidence that would justify an investigation into, let's say, Trump's business dealings and how that might influence his ability to adequately govern. So, like, if you look to the Clinton scandal around the Clinton Foundation and how people within her own campaign were concerned about how it would look that she had taken money from this actor or that actor and then advocated for this policy or that policy. You know, that level of corruption seems to be the norm in the Trump administration. So if we're going to have an investigation around impropriety like that, I think that would be justifiable. Would you agree with that?
Well, let me just answer it this way. And again, this is the point that I was trying to make with Sam Cedar. The reason why I kind of reject this dichotomized question, yes or no, did you support the investigation? The reasons for that are multifold, and I'll just elaborate on some of them. We still don't have a concrete factual accounting of the actual predicate of the investigation. So the investigation, the FBI, began in July of 2016. It wasn't revealed until the following March by Comey, when he testified before Congress at that, you know, famous – on that famous day when like the earth stood still and everybody in Washington like went, you know, to their local brunch, you know, facility or whatever. And, you know, we're riveted by this testimony. And you know, even now – and I talked to Matt Taibbi about this for the podcast that we did a couple of days ago. Even now, you know, so many aspects of Russiagate writ large have been copiously documented with almost excessive detail in some cases. And yet we still don't have a clear understanding of the, quote, origin story. I mean, there are some events or actions that are understood to maybe have played some role in precipitating the investigation, like, again, the Carter Page stuff or George Papadopoulos, but who was just basically a functionary, like a not even didn't even rise to the level of being a functionary. He was like this 29-year-old who is this extremely tangential volunteer who basically almost had no relationship with the Trump campaign at all, except in like a except in just like the sense that you'd put it on your LinkedIn or something as a formality. And then there's also this story about, you know, the head of the GCHQ intercepting something that pertained to Trump, one of his associates, and then going to John Brennan, the head of the CIA, about it. And there could be other events too that all happened in that time frame of July 2016, including, you know, my pet theory, I don't have concrete proof for this, but my strong sense is that a lot of these security state officials, in whether it was in the FBI or the CIA, were kind of reacting to this narrative that was congealing, especially in the liberal intelligentsia, as well as the neocons in the journalism world, who all around the time of, you know, around the time when Trump formally acquired the Republican nomination, all decided that he was a stooge of Putin. You know, Jeffrey Goldberg wrote a piece essentially claiming that in The Atlantic. Franklin Foer wrote a piece essentially claiming that more or less in Slate. Josh Marshall wrote a piece claiming that more or less in Talking Points Memo. And there's some other examples that all happened with this in this kind of 2 or 3 week time period in July of 2016. So I got to believe that some of these guys in the FBI, like Peter Strzok, Lisa Page, both of whom had kind of very establishmentarian, paranoid views about Russia and Russian influence, quote unquote, I have to imagine they were reading, you know, the prestige media. And I do think that there's a strong likelihood that they were just kind of reacting to, you know, the coalescence of that narrative. But this is all just to answer your question and say we don't know what the factual predicate of the investigation was. So how can I say whether I support it if I'm just at an information deficit? You know, where's the crime per se? Usually when an investigation is launched, it's to investigate a crime. And granted, this was a counterintelligence investigation initially, so it's a little different. But even in the case of a counterintelligence investigation, crimes can be uncovered ancillary to that. And so it's just not a yes or no answer for me.
If you were to find out what precipitated the investigation, what sorts of justifications would you find to be – you know, would hold water for you?
Well, I don't know. That's a weird hypothetical, right? Because I don't know. I could invent a scenario.
Just as an example, there's this concern around the hacking, not of the emails, but of voting location, like the computers for voting precincts. And there was some speculation that they had possibly even had the capacity to flip votes, and that there was a Russian hacker responsible for that. So if that was what, you know, moved the FBI to start a counter investigation, then would that be a justifiable reason to start?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose, but here's the thing: the investigation, the Crossfire Hurricane FBI investigation, launched on July 31st, 2016, was about the potential culpability of Trump or Trump associates in the Russian, quote, interference efforts. It wasn't just about the Russian interference efforts as such. And so I would have to have, again, a factual predicate that gave reasonable suspicion or something that there was tangible involvement by Trump associates. And no such evidence has yet been proffered that I'm aware of. And I've been pretty immersed in this story. And then, you know, fast forward to Mueller's appointment in May of the following year. Did I support that, quote unquote? Well, I mean, if I was always of the mind that the premises underlying this entire investigation and the narrative more generally were fallacious, then why would I say that, yes, I support an investigation that is, like, again, predicated on falsehoods? So I feel like the reason why I've been analogizing it to Iraq WMD, and, you know, Tybee has done this as well, is because I feel like they both involve false pretenses. Like, Iraq was launched on false pretenses, and as of now, it's a very reasonable inference that all this Trump-Russia investigatory activity was also launched on false pretenses. So I want to know what the actual pretenses were, and I'm more and more inclined to think that it was ideological in nature. Like, the security state reacted with such paranoid frenzy to Trump and viewed him as such a world historic menace because, again, they were reacting to the tenor of the media coverage, which really reached a fever pitch when Trump got the nomination formally, that I feel like almost as though this was all a means of wielding wielding the security state for the purpose of imposing some kind of ideological punishment on Trump. Because, you know, remember when Trump was running, he did challenge some foreign policy orthodoxies, especially vis-a-vis the Republican Party, right? And a lot of these security state officials who moved against him were Republicans. Like, I was just reading some more about this guy, Stefan Halper, who is this FBI informant. He was a professor at the University of Cambridge for many years. I actually just realized tonight that I read one of his books in college as a freshman, and it was pretty good, actually. But he ended up being recruited by the FBI to essentially, as an informant, to essentially infiltrate the campaign. And this is a Republican. I mean, this is a sort of an institutionalist Republican, so to say. So I just think there was an ideological reaction to Trump around that time that was so overwhelming that it had this manifestation in this very outsized response by this confluence of security state officials and law enforcement. And we still don't know the details of how all that came about. So again, flash forward to Mueller, and it's just like, okay, so what is the real story behind why this is all happening? Now that we have the finding that there's no conspiracy, yeah, right, or collusion,
there's no conspiracy.
It bears out my suspicion, right? Because that was the whole impetus for the investigation.
Right. Well.
So I'm not going to, like
– I mean, yeah, you can have a reason to investigate and find that that despite the initial evidence, it turns out not to be the case, that there was conspiracy. And I will say this, that, you know, that
– but the case for the conspiracy was always so weak.
Well, what
– that, again, I just didn't feel that there was a justified predicate. So let me just give you one example which just sticks out in my mind. People are still clinging to this joke that Trump cracked – in late July of 2016, again, this critical time period that I'm still trying to, you know, suss out. Right, exactly. I remember I was watching that live because it was during the Democratic convention. I remember being in Philadelphia, sitting in a Chick-fil-A, watching it on my computer, right? And Trump, before the entire assembled National Press Corps on live TV, made a joke that Russia should find Hillary's emails. And by Hillary's emails, at that point, he meant the emails that were deleted from her private server. Contravention of State Department guidelines. So like that was a legitimate thing that she was basically destroyed public records. I mean, people forget all these details now. So Trump was just kind of trolling and saying, yeah, if Russia, if you're listening, find her emails. And it was just like, OK, so now you're going to use that as a basis to infer that there's a global espionage conspiracy underway when it was a literal joke. I mean, to me, that just was such a red flag. That
who,
the entire
who really points to that? Is it just media people who point to that, or like people on Twitter, or has that been come up as a bit of evidence in any out of the Mueller campaign? I mean, or investigation? I mean,
well, I mean, whenever you watch, and I don't want to dwell on MSNBC because it's just only the tip of the rotten iceberg. But like when you whenever you watch kind of this generic MSNBC style segment on the broader Russia Trump narrative, you know, like they'll play like montages of all the supposedly damning evidence, whether it's the Trump Tower meeting of in 2016 with Veselnitskaya, or it's the you know, Roger Stone supposedly going on Twitter and predicting, you know, that Podesta's time in the barrel's coming, which they inferred was reason to believe that Stone had foreknowledge of the WikiLeaks releases. Now that we know that he absolutely did not, because Mueller indicted him and had made no reference to that at all. In fact, all the evidence furnished by Mueller is totally in total contradiction of this notion that Stone ever had foreknowledge. He was just a bullshitter, essentially. And then you have this infamous press conference where Trump made that remark. So yeah, those all get kind of melded together in this kind of montage thing, as you know, obvious reason to believe that there was a Trump-Russia conspiracy. So yeah, I mean, I think that really does play a central role in all this, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if the people in the security state apparatus reacted to it. Because remember, that joke, I don't have the exact date, but it was like mid to late July sometime. And within a week or 10 days or something, that's when the investigation launched. So it wouldn't be a stretch to conclude that it was a contributing factor.
Yeah, although I have to say this, and I know this is, you know, I'm being exactly the kind of person that you are wanting to chastise, but Trump is the kind of personality that might make a joke like that when there's some truth to it. You know, he might talk to the Russians over the TV, just even though he really is colluding or conspiring with them. I mean, like tipping his hand. What is that called in conspiracy circles? Revelation of method, right? So, I mean, the worst aspect of my own thinking says, well, you know, but I would agree that it's. I mean, there's a good reason why I'm not in charge of anything in terms of the FBI and investigating crimes and things like that, because I'm a science fiction writer and not a FBI agent.
Right.
Go ahead.
And another weird thing about like being badgered about, you know, what did you support the investigation, yes or no, is just that I don't feel that it's my proper role to be telling the FBI like what investigative course they should be taking. You know, like that's their thing. You know, I'm just I just react to what they do or do not do. Like, it's just, I don't feel it's like my journalistic, again, role to be saying, yeah.
As Director Tenet has pointed out, Secretary Powell presented evidence last week that Baghdad has failed to disarm its weapons of mass destruction, willfully attempting to evade and deceive the international community. Our particular concern is that Saddam Hussein may supply terrorists with biological, chemical, or radiological material.
The comparisons made to the investigation into the possibility that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction that precipitated the illegal invasion of Iraq. So in those days, it was clear to anyone who was – it was at least clear to me that the investigation, the kinds of reports that were coming out of the Bush administration really about evidence for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq were extremely motivated and that they were bogus. I mean, I remember at one point they released what turned out to be someone's thesis, as if it was some sort of intelligence document, but it was just somebody's kind of a book report or something.
It was like at some state college in California or something.
That they happened to find online. And so it was clear that it was motivated, and that regardless of what the evidence was, they were going to invade Iraq. And they had – it was motivated because they had that aim. Do you think that the reason the investigation started was because they had the aim of impeaching Trump?
Yes. Yes. And that's why the analogy also holds, right? Because the neoconservatives had a clearly defined objective that was acted upon, basically right after 9/11. And this was a longstanding objective, Project for a New American Century, et cetera. People should know the history of this, I would think. But the reason why they cooked the intelligence to conform, because they wanted something that conformed to their preordained narrative. And they had, again, they had an ideological goal, clearly defined ideological goal. Just go back and read the Weekly Standard or whatever. Rest in peace. Not really, but and I think it's very similar here. Again, I think that they were reacting in such a way to Trump because they perceived him as a hostile threat to the American institutional order. Probably wrongly. I mean, because Trump has kind of conformed to the American institutional order more or less, in every way but his communicative style. I mean, that just keeps getting more off the rails. But again, that's just rhetoric. It's just tweets. It's not a fundamental upending of how the American system of governance is constituted. But that's what they thought the threat was. They thought that he would undermine American institutions in such a dramatic way that they had to take these unprecedented actions against them.
I think it's really interesting. Because I think this is this ideological aim of impeaching Trump was not just the aim of the neoconservative.
Impeding. They wanted to impeach.
You don't think they wanted to impeach him? You don't think they wanted to make sure they could get rid of him?
Well, they wanted to impede him during the campaign at first. And once he won, they became even more incensed. And then it moved to, okay, we got to block him at the Electoral College. Remember, there was this move by prominent Democrats, and I was, I've been now told by these, left-ish journalist types that this never happened, but I covered it at the time. I wrote a column about it for the New York Daily News. I physically went to the Electoral College meeting in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where there had been action alerts sent and by liberal activist groups to show up and to pressure Republican electors to not vote for Trump.
Yeah, I remember that. I mean, look, I supported that at the time. I have to confess, I supported an electoral upset. And my logic was that for it to happen, Hillary Clinton would have to give up her electoral votes to a Republican, that there would have to have been a sacrifice from the Democratic Party. And it would have to – that she would have had to – the Democrats would have had to come out in the open and saying, we are doing this for the sake of the nation and take the political damage. But I supported it because I thought he was a.
And who did you support? Who would you have supported? Like, what do you want? Like Mitt Romney to get it or something?
Like that. Just someone who was a someone who was not a quote unquote fascist.
I never bought that at all.
Well, I was kicked out of a Marxist organization for being soft on Trump, and that was my position.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So.
That was weird, right? Because when I went to that particular electoral college coup attempt, that's a little bit hyperbolic, but that's what it was in a way. It was this convergence of Hillary partisans and kind of mainstream liberals, and there were some left elements there as well. And it was interesting in that way. Even conservatives too. So it was a very strange ideological formation.
And that's the thing about Trump is that he did create this very strange ideological formation in opposition to him. And I found in a little sectarian group I was a part of that a lot of things that we had been talking about for 4 years, because that's how long I kind of knew about it and was involved, under Obama just went out the window. Like all the economic analysis, all the emphasis on understanding, to be crude about it, this isn't how anyone would have put it, but the difference between the base and superstructure and the need for a radical transformation, all of that went out the window because we were facing this fascist threat from Donald Trump.
Right.
And
I never I never bought into the fascist threat analysis. I just didn't feel that that was an accurate representation of Trump, notwithstanding the threats that he did pose. I just felt the threats he posed were much more ordinary.
Yeah. Well, the problem was, I think that if you're on the fringe politically, you see the fringe more, I think, maybe, or something. Because I knew of people who had been on the left who – I think I talked to you about this last time we spoke – who became – Trump supporters, but also like out and out fascists, that it was this weird thing that happened on the far left. A few people, like kind of anarchist types, suddenly jumped ship and went way reactionary. And
yeah, see, that's weird.
Yeah. So I was concerned.
No, but it's true because, you know, like 2016, here's the way I've kind of been thinking about it. And I'm trying to formulate this into a more comprehensive theory. I do think that there was a fundamental epistemic rupture of sorts in 2016, such that like everything that preceded 2016, like you mentioned, kind of just fell by the wayside overnight. Everybody's assumptions were upended. You know, it feels like everything that we were talking about, like if we go back and like look, read what we were all debating in say 2014, it would almost seem like a totally different era, and it was just like, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. It wasn't like the guilt, you know, the dark ages or something, but it seems that way almost. Like there was a fundamental break in the trajectory of the American polity.
Right. Well, Zizek said, you know, before Trump was elected, what we were debating is whether or not transgender people should have their own bathrooms or should be allowed in the bathroom of their choice.
And the stakes just got so much higher, you know, instantaneously.
Right. And although that stuff didn't go away.
Now we're talking about a coup that was launched by the security state apparatus. It's almost like something that you would have thought would happen in like Turkey.
Right. But, and the thing is, in 2016, particularly right after Trump was elected, there would be people who were part of the far left, people who loved like Noam Chomsky, who would – not Noam Chomsky himself, but who loved Noam Chomsky, who would be just fine if the FBI had shot Donald Trump in the head, you know, really. I mean, that was the state of mind at the time. There would be no concern about, you know, standards of law or
– And people of that mindset came into alliance with liberals who, you know, 6 months prior they probably loathed. Because a lot of liberals felt the same way. I mean, just go back and look at these rants that Keith Olbermann did. I was just writing about this today for a piece for the Spectator. I mean, you forget how utterly insane it was. Like, just whatever your recollection is, it's like 10 times worse. You know, there was this one rant that he did in 2016. You got to go watch it. It was in December, right? It was like, I think, maybe a week or so before the Electoral College met, where he began by just fulminating, we are at war with Russia.
Right.
The United
States. That was actually helpful for me because I went, holy shit, I need to like step back and take a.
Yeah, exactly. I got to get. No, that's true. I mean, people had. One of my aim throughout this entire Trump era has been to urge people to be a little more dispassionate. Because when you're so emotionally invested, I mean, obviously that clouds your thinking for anybody.
You know, after Trump was elected. My wife, who's in nursing school, just about to graduate, got an email from the administration saying that if she needed a therapeutic session counseling,
mm-hmm.
that it was available to her.
Yeah. Right? College students all had their like exams postponed and stuff.
I mean, that would not have happened if Hillary Clinton got elected, right?
No.
So what was that? Why? I mean, obviously Trump is a bastard and he's crazy. In many ways, he's unhinged, I think. But
let me just tell you what else Keith Olbermann said, because it gets worse. And I think it's relevant because it brings us back to the mindset of that time. Olbermann said that, and again, Olbermann is not a fringe figure. He was the most prominent MSNBC host during the Bush and early Obama years. He kind of brought about this new style of cable news pontificating, which became emulated by others. He recruited Rachel Maddow essentially onto the network. He had this abrasive personality, so he ended up getting fired and went to a bunch of different networks or whatever. But he was doing these rants for GQ magazine, which is one of the most recognizable magazines in the U.S. And now he's back on ESPN. So he's still at the very at the center of American politics.
I have
and culture,
to say, GQ
right?
is an odd choice to lead the revolution.
He said that there was Trump. The inauguration of Trump would mark the end of the American nation state. That's what he said. So he was invoking these like utterly maximalist existential claims about the significance of Trump entering office. He said there would be the last president America would ever elect. It was over. So, I mean, if you genuinely believe that, I could understand why you'd want to do like electoral college schemes or why you'd want to get on board with the FBI and CIA to do all these extra legal machinations against Trump and his associates, why you'd want to do this 3-year investigation on Trump that was ultimately proven to be predicated on nothing, on a fiction. If that was the level of threat you thought he posed, then yeah, it's justified. The thing is that threat inflation was never justified. It was always not just exaggerated, but exaggerated to the degree of absurdity doesn't even capture it. I mean, if that was your mindset, there was just something that came fundamentally unglued.
Well, I tried to offer up an explanation behind that mindset a moment ago, but I don't think it really quite captures it because I was saying, you know, this is why the people on the far left had this mindset, but really it was anywhere from, you know, Hillary Clinton to the left that those people all had this sudden catastrophic reaction. And so I wonder what it was.
And neocons too. I mean, neocons were part of that as right. well. I mean, and that's really
yeah,
important
Beck,
to know.
Glenn Beck, I mean, who now likes Trump.
No, not Glenn Beck. I mean, Glenn Beck's not – I wouldn't say he's a neocon. I'm talking about like the David Frum people, you know. I mean, he was very much setting the tone for all this. I can remember going – because when I was at the Young Turks – I spent a lot of 2017 going to these town halls. We might have discussed this on one of the episodes we did in that time period. But there was a town hall that it was either in February or March of that year in San Diego. And at this town hall, it was a joint town hall with Susan Davis and Scott Peters. They're both Democratic representatives in San Diego County. And Susan Davis – I remember cited and quoted David Frum in her remarks to this audience full of aggrieved liberals for the most part, you know, white aggrieved liberals who showed up to these town halls and just gave her a rousing round of applause and like almost a standing ovation when she cited David Frum. So like you can't – we shouldn't underestimate the extent to which people like Frum, Jeffrey Goldberg, you know, as the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, brought Frum on to set that prominent role. Goldberg also, you know, hired people like Natasha Bertrand, who was one of the most assiduous Russiagate chroniclers, who was working on assumptions that were, again, maximalist conspiracy in orientation. So we have to be mindful of the influence that they exerted over all this as well. Max Boot, And that whole cadre. It's just so weird for me to reflect back on it now because I perceived Mitt Romney as a greater threat than Trump. And so in 2012, I can remember thinking that, you know, Mitt Romney was a greater threat because he was in bed with all the institutional Republicans. He represented no fissures in the Republican Party, so he would be able to govern a lot more easily. So he would be able to implement the Republican agenda without inhibition, essentially, and he was all on board with the foreign policy orthodoxies. So the idea that people were having this outsized reaction to Trump never made sense to me because the departures from orthodoxy that he did evince, however he ended up implementing them in office, and that's some, you know, a different topic. But during the campaign, whatever the departures from orthodoxy that he expressed were all in the direction away from the kind of Ori establishment kind of axioms. And to me, that was – I don't want to say in a normative sense that it was good, but it was – it was at least an indicator to me that there was something to be.
It was when he said that, you know, we should deal with these protesters that are at my rally violently. I remember in the good old days.
Yeah, but all that stuff was just kind of like offhand quips that never amounted to much. All of this, I feel like, comes down to this instinctive revulsion that people had at Trump as a persona.
Right. I think you're right. I do think you're largely right. I do think, though, there's got to be something a little bit more to it than that, that there's some sort of – you said something to Matt Taibbi that I thought was interesting, which you said that you felt like what we're witnessing is the end of the American empire, the American empire slowly unraveling.
The way I put it is like a kind of a paranoid outburst or – because – and I think that's best expressed by this kind of rhetoric around, quote, norms that liberals have been obsessed with and neocons about how, you know, the most grave aspect of Trump coming on the scene was this idea that he was violating all our long cherished norms. And yet the biggest norm violation of all is this entire FBI charade that's been going on. You know, I can't, we wouldn't have time to go through all the norms that have been violated. I named a couple of them to you. I mean, I guess one of the most dramatic was this idea that Rod Rosenstein, again, who is this institutionalist Republican Bush character, essentially, and Andrew McCabe, who, again, is not a partisan. These were both just kind of emblems of the American institutional apparatus, the, quote, deep state, and again, the deep state is not always what Trump said the deep state consisted of, but it's obviously a real phenomenon. And we know that because Trump was at war with the CIA during the transition period from when he was elected to when he was inaugurated. Remember, Trump in December 2016 put out a statement after the CIA released one of its preliminary findings, you know, through the Washington Post, that they had concluded that this Russia interfered to elect Trump. And Trump said something to the effect of, these are the same people that said Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. I don't believe them, whatever, whatever, whatever. And all that culminated when Trump tweeted about a week or so before he assumed office. So, you know, sometime in early to mid-January. Remember when he likened the CIA to the Third Reich? I mean, that was the point of no return in terms of open warfare between these locuses of American state power. And if that's not an indicator of just general decline, I don't know what would be.
News just broke today that you have a special team looking into why the FBI opened an investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 elections. I wonder if you can share with this committee who's on that team, why you felt a need to form that kind of a team, and what you intend to be the scope of their investigation.
Yeah, as I said in my confirmation hearing, I am going to be reviewing both the genesis and the conduct of intelligence activities directed at the Trump campaign during 2016. A lot of this has already been investigated, and a substantial portion of it has been investigated and is being investigated by the Office of Inspector General at the Department. But one of the things I want to do is pull together all the information from the various investigations that have gone on, including on the Hill and in the Department, and see if there are any remaining questions to be addressed.
And can you share with us why you feel a need to do that?
Well, for the same reason we're worried about foreign influence in elections, we want to make sure that during an election, I think spying on a political campaign is a big deal. It's a big deal. generation I grew up in, which was the Vietnam War period, you know, people were all concerned about spying on anti-war people and so forth by the government. And there were a lot of rules put in place to make sure that there's an adequate basis before our law enforcement agencies get involved in political surveillance. I'm not suggesting that those rules were violated, but I think it's important to look at that. And I'm not talking about the FBI necessarily, but intelligence agencies more broadly.
So you're not suggesting, though, that spying occurred.
I think there was spying did occur. Yes, I think spying did occur.
Well, let me...
The question is whether it was adequately predicated. And I'm not suggesting it wasn't adequately predicated, but I'd need to explore that. I think it's my obligation. Congress is usually very concerned about intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies staying in their proper lane, and I want to make sure that happened. We have a lot of rules about that. And I want to say that I've said I'm reviewing this. I haven't set up a team yet, but I have in mind having some colleagues help me pull all this information together and let me know whether there's some areas that should be looked at. And I also want to make clear, this is not launching an investigation of the FBI. To the extent there were any issues at the FBI, I do not view it as a problem that's endemic to the FBI. I think there was probably a failure among a group of leaders there at the upper echelon, and so I don't like to hear attacks about the FBI because I think the FBI is an outstanding organization, and I think, you know, Chris Wray is a great partner for me. I'm very pleased that he's there as the director, and if it becomes necessary to look over some former officials' activities, I expect that I'll be relying heavily on Chris and work closely with him in looking at that information. But that's what I'm doing. I feel I have an obligation to make sure that government power is not abused. I mean, I think that's one of the principal roles of the Attorney General.
What do you think about this Schiff, Adam Schiff, saying that it's inevitable that Mueller will testify before Congress? And have we seen the last of the investigation, do you think?
Have we seen the last of the investigation? Well, I mean, the report's going to come out in 2 weeks or so. And the thing is, you know, people are kind of like concocting conspiracy theories to explain why the report hasn't been released yet. But I mean, they're expediting the release of the report. They expedited the Barr letter. I mean, Barr put out his letter less than 48 hours after Mueller submitted the report because it reflected well on Trump. I mean, so they were trying to get it out, the main conclusion, as quickly as possible because it looked good for Trump. And they're going through the redaction process now with Mueller as a full participant because, you know, there's grand jury information, there's classified information, whatever. There's an extensive review process that has to be undertaken to put it out. So this idea that they're kind of stymieing or they're stonewalling, I don't think holds up to scrutiny. So, I mean, the report's going to come out in 2 weeks or so, and there's going to be stuff that people are going to latch onto and call for additional investigation. I'm sure Adam Schiff is going to go full bore on, you know, convening hearings related to various little details that maybe are revealed that don't bear on this kind of fundamental question of collusion, which has been disproven. But, you know, there's some, like, you know, rabbit holes he can go down or whatever. I'm sure that'll happen because, again, he, like many other Democrats, is just too invested in this narrative. I went to an Adam Schiff town hall when I was living in L.A. In that period in early 2017, and you'd be shocked because, like, essentially the town hall was about the refugee program, which is, you know, laudable because there were serious concerns around that issue at the time. And yet all the constituents wanted to hear from him was about Russia and about impeachment. We got to get this done as soon as possible. This menace is just so unconscionable that whatever it takes, get it done. I mean, that's what his affluent liberal constituents in Hollywood wanted.
Do you think that this is going to spell a second term for Trump? And what do you think that Democrats or people on the left ought to do to try to stop that from happening?
Look, on the one hand, Trump has shot himself in the foot in numerous respects. One being, and this is the most important factor, and it also plays into why the Republicans got wiped out in the House in the midterm elections. He basically outsourced his legislative agenda to Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, and that was a disaster politically for him because he ran on heterodox conservative slash, you know, even non-ideological principle. That's why he won. Generic Republican, I don't think, would have won that race. Hillary would have won. Like Hillary would have beaten Marco Rubio, for example. I mean, there's no way Marco Rubio would have won Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Ohio, you know, Michigan, and the 2nd Congressional District of Maine. So Trump didn't govern with that demographic in mind in the first 2 years. And part of it was because the Democrats launched into resistance mode and doing anything that was seen to legitimize Trump was deemed evil. So they couldn't do an infrastructure package. Again, I'm not absolving Trump himself of culpability in this, but the political dynamics were such that it was just untenable to get to, like, for him to enact an agenda that was consistent with the heterodoxies he espoused during the campaign. But that, if he had done that, that would have made him a lot more popular. Because all they got done legislatively, really, was this tax bill, which is not popular, and criminal justice reform, which is another hilarious irony, because, you know, one of the only things that Trump hasn't been able to get done legislatively is a bill that is going to eventuate in the release of tens of thousands of federal prisoners, which is like a good thing, but it's not in line with his campaign rhetoric at all, which is gives you insight into how he was just totally hobbled by Congress. And that's another thing. I mean, Corey Robin talks about this all the time, and I agree with him 100%, which is that Trump's extraordinarily weak relative to Congress, which totally undermines the whole fascistic theory. I mean, he's been hamstrung.
Well, this is the thing I like most about Trump, is that he's relatively incompetent and that he's corrupt and, you know, narcissistic and not really interested in governing. But
he's dispelled the mystique around the presidency, the office of the presidency, too. I think is actually, you know, it's been fruitful in a way.
But okay, I have in the back of my head like a super ego injunction saying you have to bring up how Trump is a racist. You have to talk about the white nationalist.
Uh-huh.
What is wrong with you? You're gonna I can feel the masses mobilizing outside my house with pitchforks right now. Because I've been so soft on Trump in this conversation. Am I losing my mind when I feel this way?
I think you're right to observe that that's kind of this pressure point always lurking in the background in terms of how you talk about Trump and this inevitability that people are going to respond indignantly and saying, oh, you're undermining the racism and the white nationalism. It's just like, if you actually listen to what the real white nationalists are saying about Trump, they're incredibly disillusioned with Trump. I mean, they think that they were swindled or they self-deluded into thinking that he was their avatar when he never was. And I was pointing this out all along. I always thought that this notion that Trump was like going to implement some kind of nefarious, far-reaching white nationalist agenda was always just a joke.
Right.
Has he? What's the evidence that he has? I haven't seen it.
Well, the Muslim ban and the
the Muslim ban. I oppose the Muslim ban. I covered the collateral damage of the Muslim ban. I went and interviewed people who I felt were unjustly affected by that, and especially disgraceful was that it targeted countries that the U.S. had destroyed in the recent past. So, like, Iraqis were harmed by it. Yemenis, et cetera. So yes, on its own merits, that was definitely one of his worst offenses. But you know, it got modified. It went through the court system. It's now enshrined partially. But I mean, the initial order he existed had to be rescinded, essentially. So it's not as if the Muslim ban, as initially conceived, is now in effect. Again, I'm not defending it. I oppose it. But it's pretty much in line with – it's almost in line with a lot of the stuff Obama – I mean, they drew on the set of countries that Obama's government had designated as national security threats. So it was more of a continuation than people want to admit. Well, you know, the bipartisan, it was a bipartisan, even a bipartisan agenda in a way. Again, people opposed it because they didn't like his rhetoric on Muslims, which, again, I didn't. I always thought that was the most morally contemptible thing about Trump. It's the targeting of Muslims, not this anti-Semitism stuff, which, again, was a joke. It was the Muslim scapegoating, which obviously he has done. But, again, is that necessarily reason to conclude that we're living under this, like, fascistic white nationalist hellscape? I mean, I don't think so. We live in a hellscape in a way, but it's for banal reasons. You know, it's not this dramatized fantasy land that a lot of people were envisioning.
So how would you place Trumpism into this story? Do you see it as a continuation? Trumpism. Is it a continuation of this neoliberal story? Do you see it as something different, a more right-wing, neo-fascist kind of assault on this? Or how do you place this into the story?
Well, I think it does Trump too much credit to call him neo-fascist. To be a neo-fascist, you have to have an ideology. And as far as I can see, his ideology is simply me. You know? I mean, there are forces that he's awakened. I mean, they're not really awakened. They're already there, but kind of opened the door for, which are pretty dangerous. But I don't think, I mean, in my feeling at least, the threat of neo-fascism is much greater in Europe, where it has a history, a basis, an institutional basis, could come back. I think what's happening here is somewhat different. I think it is pretty much what Case and Deaton pointed out, desperation. There are people, there's all kind of factors. One factor is evangelical Christianity, which is a huge phenomenon in the United States. And it hadn't been, it's become essentially the base of the Republican Party. The Republican Party went so far to the right that they can't get votes on their actual policies. Nobody's going to vote for the Ryan legislative program. So they've had to mobilize people on other grounds, nationalist, ultra-religious, so on. And that's there. But a large part of the slight swing, and it was pretty slight in the last election, was working class, lower middle class, not the very poor, but people who have lost their hope, their dignity, their sense of self-worth, who see the whole world as against them. They're being attacked from below by worthless people who, as they see it, are being helped by the federal government, attacked from above by the rich people who are taking everything, don't have jobs, their social status is gone, mortality is increasing, desperation is increasing. So they turn to their class enemy. Where else are they going to go? The Democratic Party abandoned the working class 40 years ago. In fact, a lot of these people voted for Obama, believing the rhetoric about hope and change. Okay, no hope, no change. By 2010, right here in Massachusetts, there was already a reversal. A lot of union households voted for Brown in 2010, and the Kennedy, you know, and on the seat that Kennedy had, it was quite a change. And the studies of their voting showed that a lot of it was just anger at Obama. Well, he was attacking their the rights that they had struggled for, like health rights, and he wasn't doing anything for them. So they turned to Brown. This time they turned to Trump. What's going to be interesting to see and could lead to something like neo-fascism, I think, is what will happen when the con game collapses. Sooner or later, working people are going to see that the programs that are being instituted are directed against them, case by case. You know, it's kind of hidden behind the bluster. But if you take a look at the programs, the Ryan-style programs, it's exactly what they are. So sooner or later, that game's going to collapse. And then what happens? Probably scapegoating, maybe some wild action, maybe the kind of thing that could inspire some kind of ultra-right, xenophobic movement.